Last time we met, we were looking at these notes on the themes in Proverbs. The theme we were talking about was wealth. The Proverbs, Solomon had a lot to say about wealth. He had a lot of wealth. And also, he observed people a lot. And you can't watch human society without making observations about wealth, because wealth motivates most of what most people do in some measure. If it's only seeking security by having it, or seeking power by having it, or seeking special status or pleasures because you have the money to afford it. The kinds of things that motivate people are usually connected in some way with wealth. And so Solomon, who observed people and the world a lot and had a lot of wisdom at one point in his life, made observations. Now, some of these observations should not be very surprising to us, partly because we're raised in a culture that was highly influenced by the Bible and many of the principles of wisdom that Solomon taught in Proverbs. We may have heard from our youth even if we weren't Christians, because it's kind of in our culture, but not everything. Some of the things Solomon said are quite contrary to our cultural upbringing. We were talking last time about the first part of the page, and we were talking about hard work versus easy money, one of the main subjects in Proverbs. And that's connected very closely to the subject of the sluggard. One of Solomon's favorite caricatures was the sluggard, the lazy man. And I suppose we all have a temptation to be lazy, to let other people do as much of the work as possible. Not everyone succumbs to that temptation. Some people end up doing all the work and don't appear to be lazy at all. But for the most part, we would like to consume without too much involved in production, you know. I mean, that's something that goes against nature ever since the fall. Adam and Eve were apparently given a rather easy job. I don't know. I mean, it might not have been extremely easy, but enjoyable job tending a garden, which was already pre-cultivated. They just had to keep it going. And then when they sinned, they were cast out to the wilderness outside the garden, where they had to contend with thorns and thistles. And God told Adam, in the sweat of your face, you're going to eat your bread and you're going to labor for it and so forth. And since that time, obviously, if someone's going to eat, somebody has to work for it, even if it's only hunting and gathering work. You know, I had a friend who lived for many months in Kauai in the jungle. And all he did was smoke weed and pick fruit and lived on that for the most part. And there were a lot of hippies in the jungles in Kauai did that. But that's a little bit of work, and it's not a very good living. The more you work, generally speaking, the more promise there is of elevating your standard of living and having enough. And for the Christian, it's important to not just have enough so that we're not a burden on others, but to have enough to bear the burdens of others, to help others who can't produce as much. There's always going to be people who can't produce much, that they're not lazy, they just don't have, they may be invalids, they may be disabled, they may be living in countries where there's famine and, you know, you can work as hard as you want, you're not going to make much money or have much food. They may be living in countries where they can work all day and the government takes all of it. So there's people who are not lazy, but still have need. And so no one should be lazy, because if you're lazy, if you won't work and yet you consume, then you are having somebody else work extra so that you can consume what they produce. They have to produce for themselves and their families, but also for you if you're a sluggard. So Solomon had no respect for sluggards. He mocked them cruelly. He compared a sluggard to a sluggard on his bed to a door on its hinges. He said a sluggard is so lazy that he'll put his hand out to grab something from the bowl on the table, but he's too lazy to bring it again to his mouth. He just kind of doesn't have the energy or won't expend the energy. These are caricatures, of course, but Solomon loved to make fun of sluggards. Solomon was a productive guy himself, though he's a king and had lots of slaves and so forth. He was a, energetic, industrious, had building projects and was involved in all kinds of things, including horticulture and other stuff that he tells us about in Ecclesiastes. Had a lot of hobbies. So we talked last time about Solomon's assessment of hardworking people versus lazy people. What we want to get, I want to continue in the notes to the next point, which on your notes is Roman numeral 2 and letter D. Now, there are certain proverbs that indicate that there may be something desirable about being self-employed. Now, this is not a moral value. It's more just for your own advantage, to be free from employers if possible. Now, honestly, there's kind of a trade-off, whether you start your own business and work it or whether you work for an employer. Obviously, if you start your own business, you get to keep more of the profits of your labor, but you also have the responsibility to keep the business going or else you're going to go hungry. Whereas if you work for an employer, you still have to work, but all the headaches of the company go home with the management. And if you're just a laborer for someone else, you just put in your hours and you get your fee, and you don't get as much as if you own the business or if you're working your own business, but it's got its own advantages too. But there weren't big corporations in Solomon's day. There was no industrial revolution. You know, business was not highly developed as it is in modern times. People were either usually independently wealthy, probably because they inherited wealth and had slaves working for them, and so they were getting rich off slave labor, or they were peasants, normally dirt farmers, you know, just working hard in the desert. And so Solomon seemed to think that the people who are have their own little piece of land and can farm it are in a desirable situation. He didn't indicate that that's the way you'll get extremely rich, but he did indicate that can be a secure thing. And so, let me see if I can find him. There's Proverbs 27, verses 23 through 27. He said, "Be diligent to know the state of your flocks and attend your herds, for riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the hay is removed and the tender grass shows itself and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in, the lambs will provide clothing for you and the goats the price of a field. You shall have enough goat's milk for your food and food for your household and nourishment for your maidservants." Now, this is not saying everyone should do this, but he's saying, you know, if you have your own little piece of ground and you're self-sufficient and you're not answerable to anybody else except God, then you've got kind of a good gig. You know, I mean, if you've got enough goats for your milk and sheep for your wool and you've got a garden for your vegetables and maybe you've got a cow and you look out for those things well, then you'll have enough. And subsistence was definitely enough for most Jews at that time. If you weren't one of the fabulously wealthy, you were, like I said, you're pretty much a peasant. And so if you get a little piece of land, maybe lease it, lots of time people did, then you wouldn't have to work for, you wouldn't have to be a slave. You wouldn't have to work for someone else. And, you know, I don't know what we can draw from that except that, you know, there are people who do today find it advantageous to run their own business. A lot more stress, a lot more responsibility than working for someone else. You don't get as many vacations and you don't get, you know, you don't get benefits provided. You have to provide those for yourself. But there's a certain amount of freedom which Solomon seemed to think was a positive. It's not the only positive because, of course, what they didn't have then and we do have now is big companies that hire a lot of employees, and those employees are treated reasonably good and have benefits and things like that. So obviously that can be desirable too. But you don't make your own schedule when you work for someone else. And, you know, your finances are determined by somebody else, not really entirely by how hard you work. Obviously, if you work for a company and you work harder than other people, you'll probably be promoted. You'll probably get more raises, but there's still a ceiling because you're never going to get as much as the boss, as the owner of the company does. And so having your own thing going on, at least if you're, even if you don't get rich by it, there's no one else holding you down. There's no one else putting a lid on how much you can succeed. I don't think one is better than the other. Again, the idea of working in a corporation didn't exist in Solomon's day. It's not one of the options that people had. But he was saying it's good to have self-sufficiency if you can. And that seems to be what he's saying in those particular verses. Now, when it comes to riches, remember Solomon said that a lot of things are worth more than riches. We started by looking at some of the Proverbs last time, where he said, this is worth more than riches. This is usually wisdom is worth more than riches. But here, in some verses, he mentions again and again how much a good reputation or a good name is worth more than riches. He says, for example, in Proverbs 10:9, he who has who works with integrity works securely, but he who perverts his ways will become known. Now, that's because he has a good name. You know, the guy who works with integrity has a good name. People will want to hire him if he needs to be hired. People will trust him. He'll have more clients in his business. Many employers I've had friends and relatives who owned companies, and they mentioned it's really, really difficult to find laborers who are not just there to put in the minimum and get the most they can. It's, Paul said in Colossians chapter 3 that we should, if we're servants, of course, he's talking to slaves, but if we're not slaves, but we're servants of someone else, an employee, he said that we should labor for them as unto the Lord, not with eye service, not just when they're looking, not just working hard when we can't get away with sloughing off, but work hard because the Lord's always working. He says, you're God's servant. And so to work with integrity, even if you don't get rich, is to be desired. It says in Proverbs 22:1, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. Loving favor more than silver and gold. So to have people who respect you, who know you're an honest person, who you've got a good reputation with them, that's actually worth more than money. Because if you have a good reputation, there'll usually be people around who are willing to hire you. You know, if you don't take long coffee breaks longer than you're supposed to take, if you don't go to bathroom breaks between coffee breaks, if you don't do as little work as you can get away with, you know, if the management sees or the boss sees that you're harder working than most people, that's going to count for something. At least if you don't make a lot of money, you'll be the last person they want to lay off because you're getting something done, and a lot of other sluggards are not. Proverbs 19:1, it says, better is the poor who walks in his integrity than one who is perverse with his lips and a fool. Now, better to be poor and walk in your integrity. Now, that's looking at a different angle, because I was saying that if you have integrity, you'll be in demand. You'll be valuable to an employer. You will usually be able to support yourself. And frankly, there's a very good chance that you'll be advanced in your profession if you're honest and so forth. But now he says, integrity by itself is worth more than money. In other words, even if you don't get rich, having a clear conscience is worth more than riches. There's not very many people who are rich who have a truly clean conscience. People learn to live with whatever state their conscience is in. The Bible talks about people who have seared their conscience, as it's like cauterized it. Your conscience is that organ of you that senses right from wrong, senses if you're guilty of something or if you've done the right thing. That's what the conscience is. And like other sensitive organs, like the tips of your fingers, if you're a guitar player, when you start playing guitar for the first time, you hurt your fingers. After a week of continuing, you don't feel it anymore because you're not sensitive on your fingers anymore. Why? Because you keep afflicting them. The same affliction that made you want to stop, you just keep doing it, and you ignore the affliction, and it gets callous. Well, the conscience can happen that way too. When you do something wrong, your conscience bothers you. If you keep doing it in any way, by stages, your conscience doesn't bother you, even though it's not any less wrong what you're doing. You just don't sense it's wrong. You get used to it. I remember hearing R.C. Sproul say that he didn't get saved till his, I think, college age. And as a teenager, he said the first time he fornicated, he was so felt so guilty, he went home and vomited. He just felt so awful. He wasn't even a Christian. But he said he kept living in fornication. After a while, it didn't bother him at all, you know. It's amazing how you can just get used to the nagging of the conscience until it doesn't nag anymore. Or it nags, but you've muffled it. You've made it so you can't hear it. And to have a clear conscience is, I think, a rather rare wealth in our society, because most people make whatever compromises they think most people are making. A little bit of lying here, a little bit of, you know, stealing here, a little bit of sloughing off where you should be working hard. Every time you do something you hope someone didn't see. Every time you do something you hope your boss didn't see. Anytime you realize this isn't quite what I should be doing, but everyone does this and I'll probably get away with it, your conscience gets more cauterized. It's more desensitized. But it's not clean. It's not a clear conscience. It's a conscience that's still protesting, but you've shoved it down so you're not listening to it protest anymore. And so most people, I believe, live with a fair amount of nagging guilt, which they just ignore. And they would even deny to themselves that they feel any guilt anymore because they've simply stifled it. And yet there's really nothing better than having a clear conscience, even though many times when your conscience is clear, you'll be falsely accused of things. I personally have been falsely accused of many things that I didn't do. Now, I've done bad things too. I haven't always done good things. But many times I was totally innocent of something and someone turned against me and would gossip about me or lie about me and slander me. But I just felt like, well, my conscience is clear before God. What does it matter what somebody says about me? Well, it may matter if you lose your job over it. I've never been in a position to lose my ministry because I've never been hired by anyone. I've never talked about being self-employed. But I remember when I was young, I used to have to support my ministry on the side-by-side jobs. I was living in Orange County, working at a little frozen yogurt place. It was called the Joy of Yogurt. It was at the mall in Costa Mesa. And everyone who worked there except me were family of the owner. And they'd sometimes have me close. And then the next morning they'd say, there was some money missing from the cash register after you closed. I'd say, really? How much? And they'd say, $8, $12, little amounts. But it was like, is perplexing because I'm the one who took the money from the cash register and put it in the slot in the floor to the safe. And I began to get concerned because every day they said there's money missing. And there was no one there but me who could have taken it. And I knew I wasn't doing it, so I thought, maybe I'm counting back change wrong. So I began to double count change and make sure I didn't do anything wrong. And I said, surely nothing is missing now. But the next day they say, yeah, there was another $15 missing last night. And I thought, what in the world? I said, I don't know what to say. I'm not a relative of yours. I think some of your relatives may have access here. Maybe they come at night. I don't know. I didn't want to blame them because I had no idea. But I knew I was in it, but I got fired. I eventually got fired because the money kept disappearing. And I'll never figure that one out. I mean, I really don't. If they had a nephew or something that came and took the money, he'd have to come in the middle of the night because I was there at closing. So I have no idea what happened to the money. But I knew my conscience was clear. Didn't like being fired much. You don't really want people to think you're guilty when you're not. But when you know that God knows you're not guilty, it carries you a long way. And having a clear conscience is a major value. And so that's why integrity is so important, more for your conscience than for your reputation. I mean, obviously, if you have integrity, you'll have a good reputation. But even if people ruin your reputation with slander and false accusations, if you've got integrity before God, you'll be clean and you'll feel clean and you won't be distraught because you know that God is on your side. If you actually have been compromising, then you know that God may not be entirely on your side in this matter. And then you walk around with fear. There's another place in Proverbs, I don't have it in the notes, says, the wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are bold as a lion. Yeah, why does a wicked man flee when no one pursues? Well, it's part of the problem. He's wicked. His conscience isn't clear. It makes him paranoid. You know, how many people either were or knew hippies back in the 70s who also had some marijuana in their glove box, and whenever the policeman showed up behind them, just who was paying no attention to them, they began to sweat bullets because they knew that if the policeman stopped them, they were guilty of something. Now, in many cases, they didn't get caught, but no one was pursuing, but they fled anyway, you know. The wicked flee when no one pursues. If you find a person who's paranoid, almost certainly there's something wrong with their conscience. That's Proverbs 28:1. Thank you. So, integrity is important. It's even more important than money. But when it comes to money, dealing with integrity with money is something that Solomon has a lot to say about. He says in Proverbs 21:6, getting treasures by a lying tongue is a fleeting fantasy of those who seek death. Getting money by deceit, by fraud, by lying. I've never understood why people do that, but they must just value money a whole lot more than I ever could. I mean, why would I want to risk my reputation, risk my conscience, risk my integrity before God by it just to get some money? I mean, if I were starving to death, there might be a temptation. I've never been that starving. But I mean, there are people who just like to do fraudulent things because they want more money. I think when I see people who have a lot of money, I think, so is that better? Is that better than me? I mean, I don't have a lot of money, but would I be any happier if I had all they had? I know I wouldn't, because I'm happier than they are already. I've got to be happier than they are because they're willing to compromise their conscience to get more. They're not content. Contentment is, again, what you have when you have a clear conscience. When your conscience is clear, you're not afraid. You're not paranoid. You're not walking around hoping people don't find out something about you. And people get treasures by a lying tongue. He said that's a fantasy. They think they're going to enjoy, I guess, the fruits of their frauds, but it's a fantasy and it's going to fly away. It's you know, they may feel good that they got away with something briefly, but the joy is short-lived. I don't have the impression that very many of the dishonest people I know have ever really been happy. And I don't think being dishonest helps them be happier. I think it has the opposite effect. In the next verse, no, it's not the next verse, sorry, it's Proverbs 20, verse 7. It says, the righteous man walks in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. Now, Solomon might have been thinking of leaving a blessing to your children in terms of finances, because he certainly left a lot of money to his kids. And a lot of people, that's what they hope to leave their kids. They hope to leave their kids financially set up. And I can understand that. I mean, you don't want your kids to suffer. But the man who walks in his integrity has something even better than wealth to leave. His kids can be proud of. His kids can be... they've had a role model. They will more likely have a conscience about doing things honestly themselves. You're leaving them character behind, which is worth more than leaving money behind. If you leave them both, that's fine. But if you can't leave money, at least blessed are the children of those of a man who walks in his integrity. Chapter 20 and verse 10 of Proverbs says, diverse weights and measures, they're both alike an abomination to the Lord. Now, this is a proverb that is in there twice. It's also in chapter 20, verse 23. Diverse weights and measures. I imagine most of you know what that's referring to, but if you don't, in the marketplace, things were sold by the ounce or the shekel, which is a weight. They're sold by weight, whether you're buying grain, whether you're buying, you know, any kind of produce, probably even meat, I would imagine, was sold by weight, just like it is today. But also it was paid for by weight because people didn't have coins. In most of the ancient world, there are exceptions. Ancient Greece and ancient Rome had coinage, but a lot of the other countries didn't necessarily use the imperial coins. They just paid for things by weighing out silver or some other commodity, but usually it was silver. Might be gold if you're buying something really expensive, but, you would have silver and you'd weigh it out. And so if you're buying so much grain, you'd put, you know, there'd be weights on one side of the scale and you put the grain on the other side, obviously, to determine how much it weighs, and you do the same thing with your silver. Now, if you were a crook, you know, at the market, they might have false weights for the balance, of course. And who could tell? I mean, if it was a little bit heavy or a little bit light, these weren't standardized very closely. There wasn't some government agency going around to make sure that your counterweight was exactly what it should be. So it was very possible for someone to cheat. I remember seeing when I was a kid in a Mad magazine, one of those Don Martin comics where I think it was a lady talking to the butcher across the counter. She said, "Don't try to cheat me. I see your finger on the scale." And it draws back and shows his fingers cut off. It's on the scale next to the meat she's buying. But putting the finger on the scale is sort of like having diverse weights. You know, you're faking the weight. So that when it says having diverse weights and diverse, you know, measures, that's an abomination. In other words, cheating. When you cheat people in commerce. There's a similar kind of thought in Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 14. Proverbs 20 and verse 14. It says, "It is good for nothing," cries the buyer, "but when he has gone his way, then he boasts." Now, when you're buying something in the marketplace or at a garage sale or somewhere, or even when you're bargaining for a car, you try to talk to the salesperson and say, "Oh, this has flaws. This is worthless. This is a piece of junk." But then when you get it, you boast about the great thing you got. You know, in other words, when you're on the purchasing end, you try to downplay the value of the thing that you're buying so that you don't have to spend as much. But then on the other end, you boast to your friends about the good deal you got. So it's kind of another aspect of having false weights, not having quite integrity in the marketplace in buying and selling. So integrity and a good name, those are things that Solomon believes are very important. And frankly, there's a great proverb for the need to have excellence in what you do, whatever you do. And it's Proverbs 22:29, which says, "Do you see a man who excels in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before unknown men." In other words, a man who's a laborer, just a construction guy or something like that, who excels at his work, he takes it seriously. Let's say he works as unto the Lord. People will respect him. He'll stand before important people. He'll be hired, you know, when the big contractors want to hire somebody. And I've known many, many contractors, especially in the past decade or so, that have, you know, we've called them to come out and do something around here. Sometimes they've given us a bid. Sometimes we've agreed to it. And then they don't show up again. And they don't show up when they say they're going to show up. Sometimes they never show up at all. This hasn't happened two or three times. These are people who do not excel in their work, and they're kind of people that we're not going to recommend if somebody important wants some work done. We're just not going to recommend them because they don't excel at their work. To become excellent at what you do, even if it's a menial thing, is important. You know, Solomon said this. He also, there's a story in the story of Solomon about this, and that's about Jeroboam. Jeroboam was on Solomon's work crew when he was building the temple and he was building his other projects. Jeroboam was like a foreman on the crew. But, he was made foreman by Solomon because he was very diligent, because he was a good worker, because he did good work. Solomon made him the foreman. And eventually God raised Jeroboam up to the king of the northern kingdom after it split under Rehoboam. So, in fact, Solomon began to recognize that Jeroboam was going to fill that role, and he tried to kill him, and Jeroboam fled to Egypt to get away from him. Solomon was not at one of his better times in his life at that time. And so he tried to kill Jeroboam, and he fled to Egypt. But when Solomon died and the nation split in two, the northern tribes went down to Egypt, sought Jeroboam, had him come be their king. Because he was just a construction worker. You know, he wasn't an intellectual. He wasn't a politician of any kind. He just was a good foreman on the crew, and eventually he was made king. So Solomon didn't live to see that happen, so he may not have been obviously thinking of that case, but he does say, if you see a man who excels in his work, that man's going to stand before kings, and he'll become somebody important, even though the work he does might not be one of the more respected trades in itself. Now, one of the things that the Proverbs teaches clearly, and which all Christian teaching on money brings this out, and that is to avoid debt. Now, we live in a society that's all about debt. We borrow from banks, and the banks borrow and from each other, and there's interest on everything. Under the law of Moses, Israel was not allowed to charge interest if they lent to somebody. But usually the person who was borrowing because he was really poor. I mean, he was really borrowing because he couldn't put food on the table that day for his family, so he'd borrow. And the law of Moses forbids the Israelites from taking advantage of people in that condition. And to lend to them, don't charge interest, not allowed to charge interest. Although it did say you could charge interest to foreigners. So I'm not really sure what situation, probably similar situation, poor foreigners, you could charge interest on that. Because you're supposed to treat your brother Israelites better. But debt is really only forbidden, we might say, in two places. And it's not really forbidden. The Bible does not forbid it. Some people think it's a sin to borrow money. The Bible doesn't say it's a sin to borrow money. One of the places that speaks of debt, but it's not really giving a rule about debt, is in Romans 13, which is often quoted when people are talking about debt. It's not really legislating that you can't go into debt, but it is saying something somewhat different. It's Romans 13:8, excuse me. Paul said, owe no one anything except to love one another. Now, owe no one anything sounds like don't go into debt, right? Because if you go into debt, you owe somebody. So some people see this as a moral sanction against borrowing. It actually is not intended that way. If you'll notice, this is a summary statement of the previous verses, where he said in the earlier verses, verse 7, render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor, owe no one anything except to love. Now what he's saying is, don't leave any obligation unmet. Don't remain in an indebted situation when you actually are supposed to have given over something, to pay taxes to people their taxes are due to. Now we usually pay our taxes, what, at the end of the year or something like that. So do we owe them all year long? Apparently. Yeah, we owe them. We're in debt. Even our light bills, we go in debt on a monthly basis for that. We use the electricity before we pay for it. We're in debt. We buy houses with debt. Now, it's almost impossible to live in our modern society without doing that. And Paul is not saying that it's immoral to have debt. He's saying, when he says, owe no one anything, what he actually is saying is, if you owe something, don't leave the debt outstanding. You know, how much do I owe for the electricity I've used this month before the electric company bills me? Well, I don't know, but I don't owe it until they bill me. I'm going into debt using it, but if I pay it on time, it's fine. If I'm buying a house, the bank really owns it. I don't. I'm buying it from the bank, and I'm paying payments when they're due. You know, so I'm not really neglecting a debt at all. I mean, I there may be a balance on my debt. But if I'm paying on the agreed upon schedule, then I'm not going into further debt. I mean, there are nuances, obviously, to the whole subject of debt. And that's why the Bible doesn't say that it's a sin to have debt. If it was a sin to have debt, then Jesus shouldn't have said, lend to everyone who wants to borrow from you. What, you're going to make them guilty now of being in debt to you? But, of course, Jesus said, lend without expecting anything in return, which doesn't, you might say, well, why didn't he just say, give it? Well, I think that he meant there are times to give. He also says to give to the poor, but there are people who aren't that poor, but they need something at the moment, and they're willing to borrow it and repay it, and they don't want to give. They don't want to give up their dignity by just becoming a beggar. They just need a leg up at the moment, but they can pay it back, and they want to pay it back. They want to keep their dignity. So you lend to them, But Jesus said, expect nothing in return. In other words, if it turns out they can't pay you back, then just turn that into a gift. You know, it's not immoral to be in debt. But the Proverbs tells us it's definitely not a blessing to be in debt. And anyone who's had debt that was difficult to manage, even a mortgage on a house, it's a weight. Now, once you know this after you get your mortgage paid off, you realize what a weight it was because it's not there anymore. You know, you didn't realize, wow, you know, I had to pay this and I was, you know, if I didn't pay it, I could lose my house and things like that. You know, once you get your mortgage paid off and you're out of debt, you realize what a blessing it is not to be in debt. And to live debt-free is perhaps not 100% possible in all respects, but Solomon says it's desirable. And he says it in a single line, and this is probably the main verse in the Bible that discourages debt, but it doesn't forbid it. In Proverbs 22:7, he says, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the servant to the lender." In other words, you're a slave. If you have to borrow money and you have to pay it back, you're working for that person now. You know, they own that money before you earn it. It's like you're a slave who's working for a master until you get that paid off. And you often feel somewhat enslaved if you, for example, have debt and you'd like to, travel or something like that. And you realize, well, I have to work my job. I can't take 2 weeks off. I can't afford that. If you have no debt, you can live on subsistence low. You don't have to have much of anything if you have no debt. Just enough to put food in your mouth and to keep the lights on. You know, put a little gas in the car. But if you have debt, that can be a crushing thing in hard times. And so being in debt is simply putting you in slavery to somebody until you've paid them back. And in fact, most slavery in the Old Testament was indentured. It was a debt. Somebody who couldn't pay his bills would indenture himself to somebody who would take him on as a slave for 7 years. And after 7 years, he's released. He's given his freedom because he paid off his debt, but he was a slave until it was paid off. And although we don't go into indentured slavery, there's a sense in which that principle remains. As long as you have somebody who has a claim on your money before you have the money you're working for now, they already own it. I mean, there's no sin in being a slave. The Bible doesn't forbid people to be slaves. Most people in biblical times were slaves and they weren't condemned for it. It's not their fault. But so it's not that being in debt or borrowing is itself a sin. It's not. It's not morally wrong. It's just a bummer. It's like a curse. It's like, you know, what a bummer to have to live with that hanging over your head. Now, it may be a sin if other factors render it so. That is to say, if the Bible says be content with such things as you have, and you're not, and you just go into debt because there's stuff you want that you can't afford, and you're living beyond your means, you know, just assuming that, well, I'll have enough to pay this later. Well, you don't know what tomorrow holds. You may not have enough to pay it later. We had a guest in our home last night, and his son, his adult son, is getting married, I think next week in Nashville. And he was saying that his son told him he's just gone out to got into $32,000 debt for a truck, which he didn't need. You know, and his dad was scolding him for that. You know, you don't want to go into your marriage with new debt over your head. I mean, debt is definitely not desirable, though we've gotten used to it because we can. Everybody has a credit card. You know, when my parents were growing up, they didn't have credit cards. Some stores did, you know. I think Sears, Roebuck, and May Company probably had credit cards that they issued to their customers. But these Visa cards that you can use on anything, that was unheard of when my parents were in college and when I was young. And now everyone, a kid, can get a credit card almost if his parents will co-sign. And so people just don't wait. They don't live within their means. They just say, well, I can eventually pay this back. And they get into serious problems. And, you know, the real blessedness is not to have debt. And the way to have no debt is to not live beyond your means. You know, if like when I got married, well, Dana had a house, so we were okay. But I mean, when I was younger, when I first got married as a teenager, when I was 19, I got married, I didn't have any money at all, or any guaranteed money at all. In fact, I never did in my whole life. And yet, that was the least of my concerns. And it was the least, frankly, of my bride's concerns, because they were hippies. They didn't want money either. But the thing is that there was no stress about money there. I don't remember there ever being stress, although we were poor. Just because we didn't go into debt. We lived without debt. And we lived subsistence level, which was okay. You might say, yeah, what wife would think that's okay? Well, I'll tell you, I had wives who complained about things, but they didn't complain about that. They never said anything about wanting more money. Because, you know, that just wasn't the value we had. And so it's so, life is so easy in many respects. Easier when you don't have any debt. And Solomon, when he says the borrower is the servant to the lender, anyone who's been under debt that they can't quickly pay off, they sense that. When something comes up that they could do if they weren't in debt, but they can't do it because they're in debt. And they think, man, boy, can't wait till this is paid off. Because it's an indentured slavery of sorts. Now, Solomon has some things about the way you treat poor people and employees. Solomon had a lot of slaves, a lot of servants. He was never employed by anybody. But he says in chapter 3 of Proverbs, verses 27 and 28, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due. Now, what does that mean? That means somebody that has worked for you and it's time to pay them. In biblical times, as I said, workers were dirt poor. They had to be paid at the end of every day. That's actually legislated in the law of Moses. You have to pay your workers at the end of every day because they didn't have food at home from the meager amount they got paid the previous day. They depended on the labor, the income from a single day to feed their family for that one day. And he says, do not withhold good, he means remuneration, from those to whom it is due when it is in the power of your hand to do so. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it when you have it with you. I remember when I was running a school in Oregon, we had this huge electric bill because we had this campus. It was huge at the time. It'd be huge even now, I suppose. We had about a $3,000 electric bill. And we had enough, barely, to pay for it when it came due. But there's also something else we were kind of had been hoping to do with the money. And I remember the elders got together to discuss, you know, should we pay this bill or should we stall it a little bit? They'll probably give us a grace period before they turn the lights off. And I remember this verse came up. Don't withhold it if you owe it to them, you know. So we paid them off and we had to say no to the projects we were hoping to spend the money on otherwise. But it's just nice. That's another way to stay out of debt, obviously. Because if you don't pay on time, then you've got, from that point on until you pay it, a debt. And those do accumulate. I have tried to live without debt all my life, but I haven't managed it all the time. Once I was, we bought a house in Oregon, and my grandmother donated almost enough to buy it, but not quite enough. And so I actually wanted to get a loan from a bank. I only needed $10,000. The rest of the house was paid for by a gift. And I only needed $10,000, but I had no guaranteed income. Never. And so the bank, of course, wouldn't give me a loan because I had no income. I went to my brother-in-law, who was pretty well off. I asked if he would co-sign. I didn't ask him to loan me the money. He didn't lend me the money. I didn't ask for it. But I said, would he co-sign on a loan for me? And he did. But, of course, doing so, he knew that he might end up holding the bag, which he did not. It was a 3-year loan, and I got it paid off in 2 years. I was never so happy to get something paid off as that. But, you know, I always made extra payments, so I didn't want to be in debt, even though there's somebody else on the hook for it, you know. Well, especially because someone else was on the hook for it. But I kind of went against my own principles once when I used to travel and need to get rental cars, but I couldn't get rental cars because they needed credit cards. This is before they had debit cards. Yeah, I lived before there were debit cards. And I used debit cards for renting cars now, but when I'd go to Hawaii to teach for YWAM or something, I couldn't rent a car because I didn't have a credit card. I couldn't qualify for one. And eventually they came out with these ones where, I don't know, some bank sent me an offer of a low, like $5,000 limit or something like that for a credit card. And I'll get that and I'll just use that for renting cars. I can, you know, I never would rent a car if I couldn't pay for it with cash anyway, so I'll just, but you need a card. So I started using it for that. And then there started to be books I needed. So my wife knows I need many, many books. She doesn't think I need as many as I need, but she knows the addiction. And I'll buy these discount books from Christian Discount Bookhouse so I can put them on a card. And I eventually ran up debts that I couldn't immediately pay off. My intention was to pay off the debt at the end of every month. And eventually I didn't. And so I just tore up my cards and I got it all paid off and never went into debt again, personally. I mean, there was still some debt on this house when I moved in with Dana, but I never incurred a personal debt again. And I won't. I don't need to. If there's, you know why? Because the promise of God is that you'll never lack for any good thing. And if there's things I can't afford that I would like to have, but I can't afford them, I lack for them, so they must not be a good thing. The Bible promises twice, those who fear the Lord shall not lack any good thing. So whatever I lack must not be good for me. And I have to just trust God on that. But he's certainly given me more than I desire in many, most respects. Just about every respect, frankly. Just treating people kindly when you owe them money or when they're your employees or whatever is what Solomon's talking about there. It says in Proverbs 22:16, he who oppresses the poor to increase riches and he who gives to the rich surely come to poverty. Now, oppressing the poor so that you become rich is obviously a really bad thing, but also giving to the rich. And by this, I think he means trying to curry favor with the rich by bribes and gifts and things like that, which they don't need. Here you've got poor people that you're oppressing who need stuff, and you're catering to rich people to maintain relationships in the right kind of society you want to be in. Said the person who does that will come to poverty, not because of anything natural about that transaction happening, but because obviously he's talking about in the providence of God, God will be disappointed and will bring you to poverty. Let me just go down to using money. Proverbs 3:9 says, honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase. Now, this was back when tithing was a law. But tithing, they were supposed to take 10% of all their increase and bring it to the temple to feed the Levites. But in addition to that, they, of course, could bring gratitude offerings. And they were supposed to bring the best, the first fruits. You know, some people say, why was Cain's Abel not accepted and Abel's offering was accepted? Usually the answer we get is that Cain didn't bring a blood sacrifice and Abel did. Another answer is from Hebrews 11 is that Cain didn't do it in faith and Abel brought it in faith. But we also read in Genesis that when Abel brought his offering, he brought of the firstlings of his flock. As he took the first of the increase of his flocks and gave that to the Lord. Putting God first in your finances is what Solomon says to do here. And with the first fruits of your increase, give to God. This was in addition to the tithes that they paid in the Old Testament. We don't have to pay tithes. That's not commanded in the New Testament. Giving 10% is not a rule in the New Testament. But giving to God or honoring God is because he owns all our stuff. And so whatever we have is his to be used in a way that honors him, in a way that pleases him, in a way that advances his concerns. Much of it has to do with giving to the poor. God is honored by our giving to the poor if they're legitimately poor people and in need, but also, of course, to support the church or to support, you know, missionaries, to support the advance of the gospel. That certainly is also honoring God with your possessions. But those are the two things, actually, that the Bible mentions. of course, providing for your family, that honors God too, by the way. And obviously some portion of your possessions is intended to be used that way. If you don't take care of your family, the Bible says you're worse than an unbeliever. Unbelievers take care of their families. You need to take care of yours. But on the other hand, wanting to take care of your family in a lavish, wealthy fashion is not particularly virtuous. After all, being wealthy isn't the best spiritual predictor of spiritual benefits. You know, I mean, it's a financial predictor of spiritual benefit. Being wealthy, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, Jesus said. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. So to make your kids rich, not necessarily the best thing you can do for them, you know, if it makes it harder for them to enter the kingdom of God. But taking care of your kids is obviously a biblical mandate. But apart from that, supporting the word of God, supporting the poor, these are the things that honors God with your finances. And speaking of the poor, there's quite a few proverbs about that. I'll just read through them quickly. Proverbs 11, 24 through 25. There is one who scatters and yet increases more. And there is one who withholds more than is right, but it leads to poverty. The generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. Proverbs 19, 17. He who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he will pay back what he has given. Having pity to the poor, of course, means helping them out financially. If you help the poor, you're lending to the Lord. Now, he could have said you're giving to the Lord, because Jesus said, inasmuch as you do it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. I was naked and you covered me. I was sick and you visited me. I was hungry and you fed me. And as much as you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So he could just say, whoever helps the poor, that's giving to God. And that's true. But he uses the word lends to the Lord, because he considers that God counts himself indebted to you on that. Not that God really is ever indebted to you in reality. You're going to be infinitely indebted to him no matter how much he does for you. You always receive more than you give. That's why you have some left over when you give. Everything you have is from the Lord. No matter how much you give, unless it's all of it, you have received more than you've given. So we always have received more than we've given. But God nonetheless graciously counts himself indebted when you help the poor. And so that's, of course, honoring God with your finances. Proverbs 21:13. Whoever shuts his ears to the cry of the poor will also cry himself and not be heard. So God turns it around in many cases. Now, these proverbs, remember, like all the proverbs, they're not universals. There will be people who are cruel to the poor, and they themselves die fat and happy, and they're never poor. It doesn't always turn around like this. These are characteristic providences of God. There are exceptions to them. That's how proverbs are. Proverbs are generalities. They're not promises. They're not prophecies. They're not laws. They're different than other parts of Scripture in that they're observations. They're observations about generalities. And that's a general providence of God, that if you are not kind to the poor, you may very well end up not being heard when you cry out for help. Chapter 22, verse 9. He who has a generous eye will be blessed, for he gives his bread to the poor. Blessed by whom? Obviously by God. Proverbs 28, 27. He who gives to the poor will not lack, but he who hides his eyes will have many curses. So, in the final analysis, Proverbs strongly urges us to work hard for money and give a lot of it away. And when we work for money, we should try to be excellent in our work. Why? Because we'll get a pay raise? Well, we very well might, but that's not the reason. The reason to be excellent is because you're working for God, because your employer is God. You're a servant of God. And even when no one else is watching and he's the only one watching, you want to be as diligent as if you're, you know, on camera. And these days you probably are. But I don't know if there's anywhere you can work that you're not on camera. But even if there are no cameras, even if no one has a cell phone in the room, work as if God is your master and he's the only one watching. and then honor God with what you get. Live within your means. In other words, don't be going into debt to swell your standard of living. Be content with what you have, live within your means. I'll tell you, I have always done that. I've always lived within my means, as I said, until I started buying more books than I should. Didn't do that for very long. I don't even have all those books anymore, but I have new ones. But when I did live within my means, most of the time, I mean, in the early years, I mostly was poor. I didn't feel poor because I didn't lack anything that was important. I never went into debt. I didn't. Obviously, if you're not going into debt and you're still feeding your family, you've got enough. You know, if you don't have enough, you're either not going to feed your family or you're going to go into debt. But if you're feeding your family and not going into debt, you've got enough. And I spent like my 40 earliest adult years kind of living subsistence and never lacked for anything. And giving much to the poor and to others. And God has obviously provided nicely for me. At this point, I live comfortably, but it's not anything I require. I don't find that people who have a lot of money are more contented or happier or have a cleaner conscience than I have. And those things are a whole lot worth more than money, Solomon said. That's wisdom. Some of that is, you know, rules. Some of that is morals, but for the most part, that's just wisdom from a man who at one time was the wisest man in the world and had a lot of money. I'm not saying he always was wise. He's one of those guys who knew how to give good counsel, but sometimes didn't know how to take it. But we don't have to be like that. We can take the counsel and be wise ourselves.